Welcome back, listeners. On this episode, I spoke to cinematographer Jonathan Furmansky about his work on The Dropout and Life in Beth. During our discussion, we chatted about playing middle relief on The Dropout after the first four episodes were shot by a different DP, meeting and working with Amy Schumer, and much more.
With The Dropout, I mean, I've talked to the other two cinematographers on the project, and it's been very interesting to sort of puzzle piece these all together. And it kind of sounded like a bit of a puzzle in terms of like, okay, at the beginning, we have the first sort of like four episodes that are done by one cinematographer, then you have two, and then Blake has the final two. So how were you able to sort of keep that all in your head, just and knowing what you were going to do every single day? Was it the script that was dictating this all for you, or
take that? I mean, to be perfectly honest, you know, the script was being rewritten as we went, you know, so I had my two episodes, I had those scripts when I started doing prep, but they changed a little bit as we went on. And in fact, I never saw the scripts for 7 and 8, you know, because they were rewriting them, you know, constantly as we were going. I think partially because of the whole timing thing with like the actual trial, you know, and which was happening or was about to happen when we were filming. So I think they were trying to kind of like figure out ways like, well, how do we want to incorporate this or whatever? But I didn't have to think about that much because that was, those are the episodes that were past my, you know, my commitment or purview, whatever. But what had happened was, you know, Michelle Fowler and Michael Showalter, who directed the first four, they set up such a rich kind of like palette and template for us that it was easy to kind of like jump in and say like, okay, I can kind of, I worked with Michael before, so I know where Michael kind of comes from, you know, his perspective as a director. And Michelle and I clicked like immediately in terms of like approach and like style and in what she was talking about in terms of how they wanted to shoot it. I was like 100% on board with. But then we got a little bit lucky in that in 5 and 6, and we all talked about this, that, you know, the story kind of takes a little bit of a right turn. You know, now they've reached like basically the pinnacle of their success. I mean, Theranos has reached the pinnacle of their success. And it's when like all of the fraud really starts to happen. You know, the seeds are set in the first four episodes, but in 5 and 6 is when it really starts to like take root and people start to discover and like kind of like catch on to like what's going on. So we were able to then take what Michelle and Michael had built and kind of build on it a little bit, you know, more, and say, well, how can we expand this language a little bit to it, to bring in something of this like cloak and dagger aspect of it, you know, that didn't exist before, where it was like the engine, like, you know, like the little engine that could like going up the hill for 1 through 4. And then 5 is like when they're kind of like up at the top, but then the whole thing with, you know, no spoilers, but you know, the whole thing with Ian Gibbons, you know, committing suicide and all that stuff, then it starts to feel like it's okay, we're crashing down a little bit. So we were able to take those dramatic moments and use them to kind of like push into like slightly different directions visually.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what familiarity did you have with Holmes, if any? Did you?
I had, I knew the story. I had not listened to the podcast. My dad is a biologist, so he was very familiar, you know, when it was all happening, you know, Theranos actually like going into Walgreens and like saying like all the things they can do, he was paying attention. So through him, I had heard about it a little bit as well. And I think just, I had seen the documentary, the Alex Gibney documentary, which was that also called The Dropout? I can't remember. So I had a familiarity with the bigger picture of the story, but the amount of detail that, you know, Liz Merriweather goes into and the podcast goes into on the show is like so much more substantial, and learning so much more about like who Elizabeth is and like why she behaved the way she did. And, you know, whether you can really even understand, you know, the approach of somebody like that, that was all brand new to me. Mm-hmm.
But lensing Amanda Seyfried, plays Elizabeth, what was the conversation around that? Because she has some very I mean, Elizabeth Holmes is obviously a very, I'm trying to find the right word for this. She's a little bit of a kooky character already on the top of,
yeah.
But I mean, what was the conversation around lensing her? I know there's, I think the episode that dropped last week, I mean, they're going back and forth between this interview that she's doing and,
mm-hmm.
and Kat's just sort of like frazzled woman who's trying to keep everything together and not let it all fall apart. So, I mean, how did you guys want to capture Elizabeth Holmes in this, and particularly Amanda Seyfried?
Well, I didn't have to think, you know, fortunately, I didn't have to think about that very much. I mean, I think number one, Amanda is extremely photogenic, you know, and is charismatic, you know, and so, you know, you can kind of just point the camera at her and, you know, everything is going to be interesting and amazing. But also, when I picked up the story for my episodes, it's when Elizabeth had become this kind of persona, like her version of like a Steve Jobs persona. And she had added the deep voice. She had added like this kind of like intense unblinking thing. And her day to day was always the black turtleneck. It was always her hair in a ponytail. You know, it was always this kind of like mussy eyeliner makeup thing. And so there was never like a consideration about like making her look quote unquote good. We wanted her to look like Elizabeth did in that kind of like era. Mm-hmm. So we really didn't have to talk about it too much. And then in terms of the peculiarity of who Elizabeth Holmes was at that time, with the deep voice and the unblinking eyes and all of that, you know, we tried to not highlight that in any way possible, to like just to let it stand on its own two feet, because we didn't want it to feel like we were like doing something comical. You know, we didn't want it to feel like we were doing something where we were trying to highlight that or underline it in any way that might make it seem like it's a shtick. You know, we wanted it to feel very like this is just like all very real, and this is how it really happened, and this is how, you know, she really presented herself, you know, when she was in board meetings and alone with Sonny in the apartment and all of that. So it just became a question of like just treating her kind of like a little, both Amanda and Elizabeth, as just a person in the room, and not thinking about it in a more special way, unless dramatically the scene kind of like wanted that. You know, there's that scene where she goes into her office and they want to tell her that Ian committed suicide, and she finds all those little puppets, you know, and we did want to kind of like drill down on that and say like, okay, she's kind of like lost, you know, in this moment. But it wasn't about, you know, again, like the affectations. It was just more about like, this is dramatically, like we're reaching kind of like a crossroads, you know, and Elizabeth kind of in her head is deciding like, who is she going to be? You know, like she's deciding like, is she going to be this person who is unaffected by what happens to the people around her? Or is it like, you know, is she going to be, for lack of a better way to put it, like a regular human being? Yeah, I guess one way to put it is like, my job was like not get in the way of that, you know, but just to kind of like work with the drama of it, less of the persona.
Mm-hmm. And then switching into your next project, Life and Beth,
mm-hmm.
Can you go into your history with Amy? Because you've worked with her, I think back in 2013 was your first.
That sounds right. I mean, I think so. So I met Amy, I was shooting a show called Delocated in New York, and Delocated was a really small, like indie comedy show for Adult Swim, a live action show for Adult Swim. And she came in, I think in season three, to play one of the characters' girlfriends. She and I, you know, we met, we started talking, chatting, and we got along. And she's obviously very funny and very charismatic. And at the end of Delocated, she came up to me and she said, I'm going to do a pilot. It just got greenlit by Comedy Central. And do you want to shoot it? Which I think maybe was just because I was the only DP she knew at the time. And like 3 months later, we were shooting the pilot for her show or something like that. And that 2013 sounds about right for that. And then that ended up becoming Inside Amy Schumer, which, you know, a couple seasons later, after, you know, that show on its own had gotten a lot of traction and her stand-up career had gotten a lot of attention. And then she had done Trainwreck. It became like a whole nother, you know, like the level of fame, like we kind of like saw it happen over the four seasons that I worked on that show. So, yeah. So I've known her again, basically since, you know, yeah, since before her Comedy Central career got started. Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, how were you approached for this project? Was it just a quick call and asking if you wanted to jump on the project or?
Kind of. So the creative team, by which I mean like the four executive producers who are also the four directors mm-hmm. of the show, were all the executive producers and directors from Inside Amy Schumer. Mm-hmm. So we all had, and so it was Amy, Ryan McFall, Dan Powell, and Kevin Kane. And we already knew each other very well. We had done so much work together and had stayed friends, you know, over the years on top of that. So it really was, I think Dan called me just one day and he was like, "Oh, we're doing the show with Amy. We're going to shoot it, you know, a year and a half ago, but the pandemic happened, you know, do you want to come and shoot it with us now?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Yeah, of course." You know, and I think 3 weeks later I was shooting a pilot. So maybe it was more like 6 weeks later. I was in New York. Starting to prep on Life and Beth. Mm.
And so what were those like early conversations like in terms of establishing this particular show with Amy, with the other producers? What did you want what did they want the look to be like for this?
Well, the very first things that they talked about were not thinking about the show in a conventional comedy format, by which they meant they didn't want it to be like, okay, we're going to do a scene of two people talking. We need to get a wide, we need to get a medium, we need to get a two shot and then two close-ups. Then we have to turn around and we have another thing. You know, they wanted it to feel a little bit more thought out and a little bit more, you know, shall we say, like maybe just elegant, you know, like the way that the characters kind of like interacted with the camera and the way the camera interacted with them and like how we thought about how we would cover all of these scenes. And that was the very first conversation that I had with any of them. And we reference a lot of movies from the 70s, like The Graduate, you know, or Carnal Knowledge, or even Woody Allen movies like, you know, Manhattan, where you would have a shot, you know, following somebody through a room, and then they would leave, but you'd still hear them talking, and then they would come back in, and, you know, another person would join them in the frame, and, you know, it's just like thinking about it more like, you know, the camera is just an observer, you know, in these situations. And so, and obviously that doesn't work for every scene, but that as like kind of like the base kind of visual language for everything. But even if we knew we were going to do some coverage because we had to, for whatever reason, it still informed the way that we did that coverage. It became, you know, the real kind of like bedrock, you know, of our visual language. And then after that, you know, we started talking about things a little bit more, like we got into things like color and camera movement and all of that. And that was maybe a little bit more of like an expected conversation, but it was still all rooted in this idea of thinking about it, like, what's a way that we can do this where we're not doing the expected layers and levels of coverage that, you know, you would typically do on a half hour comedy show. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what were some of the challenges that you had on this particular project?
Well, you know, trying to come up with something that does suit that idea of very simple coverage, sometimes single camera coverage, single shot coverage for a lot of things, is challenging on its own. But that's an enjoyable challenge. Like that's a creative challenge. That's really a fun problem to solve. But we were shooting in COVID, you know, and so we had the COVID issues to deal with. And then we were in New York and Long Island and upstate New York in the spring and summer, where a lot of times we didn't have cooperative weather. We got rained out 5 or 6 days or something like that. We had heat that, you know, we had crew members passing out because the heat was so high and people had to be wearing masks, you know, and everything. And so we had to deal with all that. And It was, you know, but other than that, like, you know, it was, there's challenges to every shoot, you know, because we all want to be ambitious and we all want to kind of like push beyond whatever, like the boundaries are that are set up by the schedule or the budget. But because we had this kind of like me and the four directors, we all had this kind of like this really long history. We were able to communicate very efficiently. You know, we were able to move very quickly and make decisions very quickly. And so it became less about like, you know, trying to figure things out, and it became more about, because, you know, at a certain point they were kind of like, well, Jonathan's just going to take care of like the visual stuff. We're going to worry about the story and the jokes and the drama and the acting. And, you know, it became more about just like, how can we, you know, how can we do this in a way that satisfies the drama, doesn't get in the way of the comedy, and somehow fits in this idea that we're not going to get like a bunch of coverage and a bunch of shots and a bunch of other stuff that, you know, we don't necessarily need.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, what is it about like that team of four that just keeps that engine rolling?
I think it's, you know, it's a number of things. I think number one is like mutual respect. You know, we've all done enough work together, and those four have done enough work together that there's implicit trust, and that everybody understands that everyone's advocating for what they think is the best solution for or answer for the project. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a level of loyalty that people develop, you know, where if maybe loyalty is the wrong word, but so if, you know, we're having a conversation about something and somebody says, I feel very strongly that this is the way to do this, you know, everybody else can say, well, I might not see it, but I know what this person is talking about, you know, and I want them to feel like, you know, they have as much of a voice as I do. And so, I mean, maybe that just goes back to respect, you know, like just a level of respect and trust, you know, that you only get from like working with people for like literally a decade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that probably is the secret sauce. And then of course, you know, we spent in prep, we spent, you know, we had umpteen million Zoom calls, like for 2 or 3 hours talking about every scene and, you know, going through all the locations and talking about like, what is this about? Is this the best solution? Do we need to rewrite this? I mean, I wasn't involved in like the writing conversations or anything like that, but, you know, it's once we came out of all of that conversation and we had that level of trust, by the time we got to set, we all had a really good idea of like what all the scenes were about. And so again, it was easy for me to then just go like, okay, I'm going to figure out how to shoot this in a way that makes sense. And they can just concentrate on the acting and the story and the comedy, you know, and all of that. And So I guess that's a really long way to say respect and trust.
No, it's perfect. And I mean, what, for both of these shows, I mean, what are the biggest takeaways for you?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, The Dropout was interesting for me because it was the first time that I had worked on a show where I had come in the middle. You know, every other show I had done, even if I had not done every episode, I was there at the beginning. So I was kind of like a voice in kind of creating whatever the language was and dealing with all that. And so this, like I said, you know, it was really easy, you know, for me to jump in because I felt like I was very quickly on the same page with Michelle and Michael and all the other producers and you know, executives involved about what the show wants to look like. So it wasn't a problem, but it was also a little bit different, you know, being kind of like the new kid at school, you know, so to speak, and starting to work with a crew that had been, I think by the time I started working with them, they were already like 35 days in or something like that. You know, so they're a well-oiled machine. I'm coming in, I'm not looking to like upset the cart, but I also have my own mandates and I have a director that I'm working with, you know, and we're trying to like push things and make things interesting. So, you know, that was an interesting situation for me, just being like, okay, yeah, the new kid at school and saying like, okay, let's do this. You guys kind of know what you're doing. I mean, I shouldn't even put it that way. You guys know what you're doing, period, full stop. I just want to bring in like some kind of like a slightly new perspective Because like I was saying before, the story is basically taking a little bit of a right turn, you know, so let's incorporate all of this together. So that was maybe my biggest takeaway from The Dropout, was just learning and like knowing that I could go into that environment and it could work, you know, and I could feel still like creatively like engaged and fulfilled, you know, and I'm doing certain proper service to the show, you know, which is a big fear. You know, you don't want to come in and be like, well, I'm just going to do whatever the hell I want. And all of a sudden my episodes feel like they're a full departure from what had been established before. You know, it's very important, especially on a limited series, that it's one experience, you know, from start to finish. Even if it changes, you know, have to feel the change. It can't be like, it can't be like all of a sudden you like flip a switch and it's something new. So that was probably the biggest takeaway for me. I mean, it was also like an amazing story, and like we got to shoot on these like sets that were fantastic. You know, we got to do a lot of fun lighting, and so all of that was great. But you know, it was really the, you know, like the being the kind of, I guess you could call it, using a baseball analogy, I was like the middle relief. Yeah, and then Blake was the closer. So then for Life and Beth, you know, I kind of took away a lot of things from Life and Beth, and partially it was going back to that idea of like thinking about the show in a, maybe a slightly unconventional way. You know, it gave me a lot of confidence that, you know, you can bring ideas to the table that aren't necessarily like expected ones, and maybe they're not the right choice in that very moment, but that there's room for pushing whatever those boundaries are, in a way that I wasn't kind of like, you know, fully expecting. And even like doing things like, and this is going to get a little bit nerdy for a second, you know, but I spent a lot of time with people at Panavision coming up with this lens package that I wanted to kind of use to showcase the modern day footage and then contrast it with the flashback footage. And I had this big idea about like, we'd use these lenses for the modern and the other lenses for the flashback. And after a couple of weeks, like I started thinking like, well, actually, I just want to pick a lens that I think fits for whatever we're doing in this shot. And I just started mixing everything together, you know, zoom lenses, prime lenses, like extremely fast lenses, slower lenses, you know, just kind of like running the whole gamut. And that ended up being, for me, really fun, but also brand new, because before that, on every other show that I'd ever done, I worked really hard to get like every lens to match as closely as possible, you know, like get a set of primes that's like perfectly matched. If I had a zoom, get the one that's matched the best, you know, and try and make it feel like, you know, it's like one perspective, one, you know, lens perspective, you know, from start to finish, you know, from super wide to super tight and everything in between. But here, you know, it was just kind of tackling everything individually and saying like, well, okay, in this scene, it feels kind of like this. And I want to use this lens and I want to be at this stop. And, you know, that just feels like the right feeling. Even though it doesn't really adhere to the rules, my own rules that I had set up, you know, at the outset. Mm-hmm.
And then I guess final question for you, I mean, what's next?
So I just finished a show for Showtime called I Love That For You, which is coming out next month, very fast. That's another comedy show. It's with Vanessa Bayer, yeah. Who an SNL alum, and it's about a woman who works at a home shopping network. And she ends up kind of like living this lie, you know, unintentionally living this lie. And there's the fallout from all of that. And it's tonally very different from Life and Beth and The Dropout. But it was super fun to work on and a lot of great people. And we're all really proud of that. So I'm excited for that to come out. And I'm just starting prep on a feature film that's kind of like a mockumentary in the veins of like Waiting for Guffman or Spinal Tap, and which is about a little theater company in Glendale. And again, like a comedy, but like I come from a documentary background, like, you know, ages ago. And so I'm really excited to put like my documentary cap on, even though it's a fully scripted, you know, movie, just as an approach, you know, to shoot it like and think as a documentarian, as opposed to just like a narrative cinematographer will be, again, really fun.
Thank you all for listening. This episode was edited and produced by me, Jackson Vickery. Graphics were done by Dylan Michael, and the opening and closing theme were done by Sterling Gavinsky.